Okay, it's time for me to introduce our speaker. I want to tell you, I met the speaker around, 8 or 9 months ago when I was visiting a Tucker group. I didn't even know where Tucker was, but I went to support a friend of mine. And, I had a talk with God today. I wanted to thank him for letting me have my meeting, and he told me it wasn't my meeting, it was your meeting. So for your meeting, I found a speaker who... He makes me want to succeed, and he lets me know that the promises are out there. We just have to be patient. His name is Ed Tingley, and I'm going to go ahead and just let him come up now so he can have the most time possible. Please welcome Ed.
Is this why you didn't answer your cell phone? Oh, my goodness. There's a few people here. I'm going to be nervous, and that's okay. Take a deep breath. Pretend all you guys are naked. And everything will be just fine. Okay, my name's Ed Tingley, and I'm a real alcoholic. I was born April 1st, which is April Fool's Day. For anybody that don't know that, and I've heard every April Fool's joke there is to be heard about my birthday, but it was in 1943, so due to math, if you don't have a calculator with you, that makes me 64 years old, okay? I'll be 65 in April, and retiring! Yay! I was going to say a little funny up here because I like to just kind of get loose a little bit because I know I get nervous when I get up here. And I probably if I get up here 1,000 times more, I'll probably still get nervous 1,000 times more. It's really strange being up here for this alcoholic anyway. I was going to tell you that I almost didn't make it here tonight. But as fate has it, I almost didn't make it here tonight. There's a 7-car pileup on 285. I left Tucker at 6:30 and just got here. So anyway, what I was going to say was that I almost didn't make it here tonight because in 1959, I was in a severe alcohol-related accident where one person lost his life. And I was in the hospital, and when I arrived at the hospital, my heart was not working. So they brought me back, and they told my family that I wouldn't make it through the night. So I almost didn't get here tonight. So this first sponsor that I had told me that one of the most important things that I can do is be grateful for today, because by all rights, I really shouldn't be here. I shouldn't be alive. So I am grateful. And I brought some notes to keep me in line here. Okay. Okay, let's see. I'm going to give you a real quick work history because she told me I got 40 minutes to talk, and I'll tell you what. I'm going to tell you about 33 years of drinking and 18 years of sobriety in 33 minutes. That's going to be pretty difficult. My sobriety date is May the 18th, 1990. I started out in my life as a shoeshine boy in my daddy's barbershop. At 8 years old, I was working. I was also working, and I'm looking around here to see if anybody's old enough, and I don't see too many people. I see one or two maybe that might be old enough to know what a pin setter is. Does anybody know what a pin setter is? Let me see your hands. Not an automatic pin setter. I'm talking about a human pin setter. Well, that's what I was. I was a shoeshine boy at my daddy's barbershop on Friday and Saturday, and during the week I worked in a bowling alley setting pins. And for the ones that don't know what that is, you stand in a pit, and you put your foot on a pedal, and it makes these little pins come up. And you set the bowling pins on top of those because they got a hole drilled in the bottom of them. Set them on top of there, and then you let go of the treadle. And when you let go of the treadle, the light lights to let them know it's okay to bowl, you know. And you best get the hell out of the hole because the guys just love to try to hit you with the pins, you know. I mean, I think that's part of the sport. And if you get hit a couple times, the tips are better. They used to slide tips down the bowling alley. Anyway, I went from that to wanting, I guess, like, I don't know, what was it, Sleepless in Seattle, where the guy just liked having a restaurant, and he wanted a 50s restaurant, and that's just what he wanted. I was that way about a barbershop. I just loved being in the barbershop, loved being around hair, loved what was happening. I cleaned mirrors and swept the floors. My dad taught me how to use a straight razor, and I started shaving and doing massages and that kind of stuff. My dad and I were cleaning the barbershop when I was 11 years old, January the 5th, 1954. And he dropped dead on the floor with a heart attack. I still wanted to be a barber. My mother had no part of it. She was to tell me, you know, that my dad had put money aside for me to go to college. She wanted me to go to college and, you know, to be somebody. I was supposed to be a dentist or a doctor or a lawyer or whatever one of y'all are out there, I'm sure. But that wasn't to be because, see, I'm an alcoholic, and when I make up my mind to do something, I damn well do it. You know, come hell or high water, it's going to get done, and it got done. I went down and lied about my age to the barber board. And went to barber school, lied them. I started going to barber school on weekends and going to school during the week. And I did that for a short period of time because my dad had taught me how to cut hair previously. I did that for a short period of time. The instructor came to me and said, you know, you're wasting my time. I'm wasting yours. Get the hell out of here. Here's your license. You know, and I went to work. I was 14 years old. I was working in a barbershop full time. And I was the only kid that had money, you know. And I remember my first Easter, and back in those days, Easter, everybody got a haircut on Easter. I mean, you had to be clean cut and all this kind of stuff on Easter Sunday, you know. And it was a busy week for me, and I made $76 that week. And I was like, wow, I didn't know what to do with all that money, you know. I really didn't. Let's see. I went from there to wanting to open my own barbershop, and I knew my dad had put money aside, and I went to mom again, and mother said no, that wasn't going to happen. I said yes, and it happened. My father was pretty well known in the business. I went down to just see how much money I needed to set this thing up, because I had a place already picked out. And I went down there, and lo and behold, Jack Kramer was the guy's name. He owned the barber board, not the barber board. He owned the barber supply. He knew my dad, and he backed me. So at 20 years old, I was in business for myself. I had four barbers working for me. I had a five-chair shop in a little town about as big as Stone Mountain, if y'all know where that is. It was just like four blocks long. Nothing big, nothing bigger than a two-story building anywhere. Jack Kramer played an important part in my life at that point. He not only set me up in business, but he started me on a road to somewhere that I never dreamed I'd go. I always get emotional when I do this, you know, because, you know, I look back at my life, and I've had a lot of good things happen to me. Not everything I did in my drinking days was bad, you know, and not every bit of my life in my drinking days was lousy. You know, a lot of it was good. And Jack asked me to go to Washington and compete in a haircutting contest in Washington, D.C. It was a tri-state, three-state award. I competed against whatever things I knew, you know, scared to death, petrified, didn't have any idea what the hell I was going to do, and I competed. And my model that I took with me. I was getting ready to leave. I was out of there, you know, after the contest was over. And he said, no, let's hang around and see who won it. You know, and I said, oh, well, I don't really want to. I said, I'd rather go home. Come on, let's hang around. You know, and he talked me into staying. Well, this guy, his name was Ivan of Toronto, announced winners. And he got up there and said he was going to announce the first place first, second place, and then third place, and then award the third place to give the second and first place a chance to get their wits about them, you know, to come up and accept the trophy. Because at this time, that was the largest trophy ever awarded to a hairdresser in the United States, you know. And he called out my name. Freaked me, I tell you. Now it's going to start getting to stuff that you can understand, because that did something to me that just incredibly changed my life and changed my thinking. I went on to compete in another one in Delaware for another tri-state. I won that one. I went from there to New York to compete in worldwide competition. I won 3 years in a row. Quite the avid hairdresser I was. And there I met a guy. Got to tell you about Washington first, though. On my way home from Washington, now my mother and my father didn't drink. I had no idea where my drinking came from. I couldn't tell you. I can now, but I couldn't at that time. But I can recall buying at the first store that we came to, I bought a quart of bourbon, old granddad, 100 proof. That was my drink. I drank all but about that much of that bottle from Washington, D.C. to Baltimore City. And in case you don't know it, it's 40 miles. My mother lived in a little, they call them brownstones, they call them townhomes and all this kind of stuff. Now, when I was a kid, they were row houses, you know, and that's where I was raised, in a row house. And it had a concrete or a cement, brick and cement railing around the front porch. And I was walking on that railing with a bottle in one hand and that great big trophy in the other hand, saying, sure wish Dad could see me now. You know, Dad probably rolled over in his grave that night. But I went on and I went on, got into New York. I was working on the side of Vidal Sassoon and Paul Mitchell. Neither one of those guys were anybody then, and neither was I. But we had all won contests, and we were all working together, and we had some fun together. We really did. We were in the lobby one time, and we got these guys are not around anymore, so I can talk about them. It's okay. But Vidal Sassoon was sitting there, and Paul Mitchell and I were getting him drunk. I had my partner to be with us then, too. It was four of us. And we asked Vidal how he came up with these crazy haircuts that he comes up with, you know, always one side long, the other side short, one side curly, the other side straight, color the same way, and all this kind of stuff. And he said, well, he says, I do one side. He says, I back up. And I look at the bitch, excuse me. And if I don't like it, I do the other side different. So when she walks out of the salon, I like one side. But that's his trademark. Anybody knows anything about him, that's his trademark. If you see a haircut that's lopsided, it's a Vidal Sassoon, and they paid a lot of money for it, I guarantee you. But we had guys that would hang upside down, hang their customers upside down and cut their hair with a blowtorch. I mean, there was crazy things happening in New York City, I can tell you. I went on to meet a fellow in New York. His name was Bernie Meyer. He's not with us anymore. He went over to Germany on exchange student kind of thing and learned to manufacture women's wigs and men's hair pieces. And he married the boss's daughter on the exchange student thing and brought her back to Maryland with him. And he wanted to go in business, and he wanted somebody that could represent the company, and he wanted me as a partner. And so it was he and his brother and myself, the three of us, we went into manufacturing. Our mother firm was in Munich, Germany. Our we had a company in Seoul, Korea, and we had a manufacturing company in Haiti, and one in Baltimore, Maryland, right at the harbor. And this went on for several years, and we made a lot of money, and we really did a lot of stuff, and I did a lot of platform work. I was in New York all the time, and every time there was a show around anywhere, I went there and I represented our company, and I did demonstration work standing up there in front of a lot of people. And you know, you get nervous when you get up there in front of a lot of people, and unlike tonight, I could take a drink. So I drank enough to where I get calm, and then I get out there and perform in front of all these people. My drinking was to take me from there. House on the hill, wife that didn't understand me. I guess that's a husband that didn't understand family is what it amounted to. Because, I didn't understand. She had a new home. She had a pool in the backyard. She had guys taking care of the grass. She had people taking care of the pool. When our oldest daughter was 16, she got a brand new car for her birthday. What more could a woman want? But somehow or another, turns out she wanted a husband. And I was never there. So she gave me an ultimatum. Now you're going to see the real alcoholic come out of me, because she gave me an ultimatum and told me, look, either get out of the business or find another family. And I opted to get out of the business. I sold my half of the company to my partner. I went about to do the most stupid thing I ever did in my life. I opened up another hair salon. I opened a woman's hair salon, and I hired my wife as my secretary and receptionist. We went from not seeing each other at all to seeing each other 24 hours a day. She found out how much I drank. That destroyed that marriage. Had I known that then, I'd have kept the business. but you just don't know. Hindsight's always 20/20, isn't it? But anyway, let's see. From there, my resume goes from having that salon. My wife had a boyfriend. I went in a bottle, and I had a salon that was incredible. I had a full bar, and I served alcohol to my customers, my ladies. Whenever they drank, they couldn't smell it on me. That was the whole game, And I could be tipsy or rocked, and, nobody knew it. It was cool. And I was getting like Vidal Sassoon, And if I didn't like one side, I cut the other side different. Who cares? My show name was Edguardo, and that's with a G. Edguardo. Edguardo of Toronto. Never been to Toronto in my life. But that's what my handle was. Let's see, where'd we go from there? A downhill slide. I crawled in the bottle when that marriage busted up. And I mean, literally, crawled in the bottle. I found a job working, because of my experience in sales, with my own company. I found myself working for this company selling industrial equipment and traveling all over the United States, because that was my answer to everything, was just to get the hell away from it. Just walk away, get out of it, get away from it, And that's what I did. And I wound up traveling. We go north in the summertime, and we go south in the wintertime. We were traveling like birds, and we were selling a lot of equipment, and we were drinking a lot of booze, and we were doing a lot of snow, and we were spending more money than we were making, and we were making a hell of a lot of money, And my sister rescued me. I was coming through South Carolina, and I thought I was rescuing her. She had gone through a divorce, and she had a horse farm. She was raising Tennessee Walkers. And I was going to stop and help her take care of the place until she could get on her feet and sell it and all this kind of stuff. And little did I know, she was going to Al-Anon already because of her husband. And she knew exactly what she was doing. And, she's part of the result of me finding my way into this program. But I didn't see it then. I went on in Louisiana. When I moved in with her, I had to go back to Baltimore and get my car. That was an important thing to me. I had a 1976 Thunderbird, and that was an important thing to me because out of the divorce money, that was one of the things I did with my money. I went out and bought me a new T-Bird, and, that's, and then I put it in the garage and traveled for 4 years. So here I got a five-year-old car with less than 10,000 miles on it, you know, and I brought it down here. I went up there, and I couldn't get a tag. It was a Catch-20. I couldn't get a tag for it in Maryland because I didn't live there. I couldn't get a tag for it in South Carolina, which is where I was living then, because the car wasn't there, and it couldn't get inspected. So I opted to change the numbers on the tag to the right date and drive to South Carolina with a hand-painted tag. Do I need to tell you I got stopped? It was in Virginia. I got a pretty good ways now. Think about it. I got to Virginia, and this cop pulled me over and asked me if I'd been drinking. Of course, I had two, you know. We all had two. Yeah. Anyway, I was to spend that night in jail in Virginia. They took me, and I don't know if you all know this or not, but I swear, I think they count your money, you know, while you're in the jail waiting for the judge to show up, because he left me enough gas money to get back to South Carolina and took the rest as a fine and let me go out of there and drive my T-Bird with a bad tag on it away from the courthouse. Figure that one out, you know. I didn't get stopped again, and I made it. Got down to South Carolina, got, let's see, where was I? Brought my car down to South Carolina. Tried to find a job. I was looking. My work went. That's where I was. My work. I was in South Carolina. I was started out as a clerk in a liquor store. Good place for me. I was only there a few months, and because of my background and my experience, I wound up as the district, or actually I was the general manager for it, because they had seven liquor stores in Columbia, South Carolina, and I was the manager of all seven liquor stores. That was fun. Then some idiot come along and saw me and liked what he saw and offered me a job for a liquor distributor and gave me a company car. Took me for a tour through the warehouse and said, "Now, I expect you to take at least a bottle a night home with you. I want you to know what you're selling." I died and went to heaven. I'm telling you. Well, he made a bad investment, not just in me. But he made a bad investment in Coors Beer. He thought it was going to be as big as Budweiser, and he dumped all of his money into Coors Beer, and it fell on its butt, and so did he. So I left there, and I started selling steel buildings. I couldn't stay out of the bottle long enough to sell anything, really. And I finally wound up in North Augusta, South Carolina. And I was looking for something to do that I could do because my hands were shaking too bad. I couldn't hardly speak. And I decided I was going to get sober because I went to a doctor, and he's treating me for high blood pressure. And he told me, you know, that until I stopped drinking, my blood pressure wasn't going to be under control and I could die from a stroke. Like, okay, what should I do about it? He said, "Well, you got a big church there in North Augusta. Join that church." And I did. I joined the church. And I stopped drinking. It was cool. I mean, I lasted 2.5 years without a drink. And because of the church, because of the people that I was around, and I picked up a hobby as model trains, so I had something to do, you know, and I knew nothing about AA program. I was just doing my program. This was the Ed Tingley doctor program, you know. And we started a singles club in the church. That was the beginning of the end. We got this thing organized, and it was like an AA meeting. It really was. We had women and men there from 76 years old to 15 years old. I mean, it was all kind of single people in that group, and they were all Christians. You know, so how much trouble can you get into with a room full of Christians, you know? anyway, one of the parishioners in the church donated two condos, actually, on the ocean for us to use, and the church gave us the bus. One of the guys got on the bus with a cooler full of Budweiser. Goodbye, Ed. I don't remember the weekend. I woke up in my own apartment in my bed. My car was missing. It was still over in the church parking lot. So, anyway, I don't know. That was my beginning of the end. I wound up getting married in a blackout. I didn't know that. I did not know that until I got into AA and got sober and got served with divorce papers. I remember looking at those papers and thinking, damn, it was real. I don't know. I thought somehow or another in a drunken stupor we were just fooling around. You know, I didn't realize it was for real, you know. And she was kind of, here I am, penniless, trying to get sober again, and she wants to sue me for alimony. I was like, whoa, I had to get a lawyer. You know, I was like, what do I do now? I found a lawyer. It was in the program, believe it or not, and it was a lady, and she got me a divorce, and I had to pay her $150. I've had a problem with ladies over my life. I was in love the first time, I believe, at 13. Told my mother I was going to get married. I was serious. I was 13. My dad wasn't around. I was the man of the house. I knew what the hell was going on. You know, I'm not a child. I'm 13. You know. Well, her name was Vicki Guthrie, and I still got pieces of a tattoo on my arm from her. I was raised in some gangs and city life, you know, and you did that kind of stuff when you were kids in that kind of situation, in Baltimore City anyway. But then I met this Italian girl. She was just a little Italian, about like being a little pregnant, you know. But she wasn't that either. Her name was Helena Geraldina Rendoni. Nice Italian girl. I met her at a party, and I walked outside to smoke a cigarette, and being as grown up as I thought I was and knowing what all the worldly things that I thought I knew, I had never been French kissed. This Italian girl laid a kiss on me that I'll remember to my grave. I had never experienced anything like that in my life. I divorced my love from 13 years old and fell in love with this Italian girl. Needless to say, Vicki and I didn't get married, but the Italian girl and I did, you know. And that lasted 7 years. We had a son, and he was born 6-6-60. Scary numbers. And he was to carry on a life like his dad. In fact, now I have no unearthly idea where he is. I hear from him. He's under bridges. I hear from him again. He's got a phone and a job. I hear from him again. He's under a bridge again. You know, so he's homeless, and then he's not. You know, and I was there myself. You know, I've been homeless a couple times before I found this program. Let me tell you, folks, I got 6 minutes to tell you about 18 years of recovery, and that's going to be difficult. I came into this program kicking and screaming like most people do, and I just wanted to learn how to drink. I didn't have a problem with, I wasn't a drunk, I wasn't an alcoholic. I drank too much and I abused alcohol, and I would admit to that, but no more, you know, no more than that. I had a roommate that I had salvaged from another job. I was selling waterbeds then. But anyway, I had salvaged this guy from another job that I had lost. And I bumped into him, and he was living in a motel. So, you know, I said, well, okay, why don't we get an apartment? You know, we could share, da-da-da-da, you know, and whatever. And I conned him into paying me the a couple of months' rent in advance, you know, because I didn't trust him. The fact was I didn't have the money, you know. So anyway, I finagled that, and I got into an apartment with him. And that son of a gun, he was always whistling. He was always smiling. He was always dancing through the damn apartment. You know, he used to just aggravate the heck out of me. And this one night, one of my buddies from work decided we were going to tie one on because we had 5 days off, and we tied one on. And I woke up the next morning, And this guy comes whistling through the daggone apartment again. And he says, "You know, you're going to kill yourself." I said, "What do you mean?" I said, "You know, we must have had a wild party last night." I said, "There's clothes all over the place, you know." And he said, "Wild party last night?" "No, it went on for a week." He says, "You got to go to work tomorrow." Flipped me out because I had no unearthly idea. And I'm like, "Well," he says, "and you haven't eaten anything all week. You haven't had a bite to eat, just booze." He said, "Why don't you come with me to a meeting tonight?" He was in the program Alcoholics Anonymous, and I didn't know it. And he kept that anonymous, you know, and until it worked, until I needed it, and then he hit me with it. And bless his heart, he's out there now. Pray for him. Because it was a short time after I got sober, he went back out. And I haven't seen him since, you know, so I don't really know what happened. But he busted my apartment up pretty bad before we left. I mean, because he was angry at me because I was sober and he wasn't. You know how we do. And he busted the place up pretty bad. And I went to get a hold of my sponsor. I had a very sensible sponsor then. He was the manager for Tattletales. See how sensible I was when I got sober? You know. Anyway, he took me over to his house because the glass was all over the place. And I had this little dog. And this little dog was part of my sobriety. I would come home from the Waffle House, you know, and we would sit at the Waffle House till 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. I'd come home from the Waffle House, and the dog would jump up and smell my breath to see if I'd been drinking. Had nothing to do with the sausage I ate. You know, it had to be because he was smelling my breath, you know. I really thought that. And I tell you what, I'm not so sure I wasn't right. But... But anyway, I got in the program, and I found this other, after he went back out, I didn't know what the hell to do, and I wanted to get a roommate, and my sponsor said, "Can you afford an apartment?" And I had a job then at Haverty's. I guess I can say that. And I was making okay money, and he said, "What I want you to do," now, how many people in here have seen the movie 28 Days? Okay. Do you know the part in the end where the guy is trying to convince the florist that he didn't kill that damn plant? My sponsor made me do that, and that was before that movie was out. You know, he said, "Ed, what I want you to do is get a plant." He said, "Now you keep that plant for a year and water it and take care of it. And if at the end of the year it's alive, get a dog. And at the end of another year, if the dog and you get along and the plant's still alive, you might be ready for a relationship." You know, it's like, man, this is a death sentence. But I did it. I did it because I wanted to stay sober, and I did it because I wanted to live. You know, and that's all I can say about that. It worked for me. And then I wound up with a roommate, and my roommate and I were best of friends for years, and we still are. I mean, he's a great guy. You know, he really is. He's from Chicago, you know. But he's a real neat guy. We never had an argument. And that sounds hard to believe, but we never had an argument. He worked his program. I worked my program. We worked through our differences, and we never argued. And that was a phenomenal thing for me. I didn't know how to live like that. You know, that was great. Then one night we heard machine gun fire going off. We're living in Stone Mountain in an apartment, and we hear this machine gun going off in the middle of the night, you know, and then about two nights later I got robbed at gunpoint. That was the second gunfight I'd ever been in. The first one I had a gun, the second one I didn't. So when you're in a gunfight without a gun, you lose. I'm here to tell you, you lose. I was just about getting close enough to this guy to take his gun from him when another guy walked around the other end of the car and cocked his, and he was out of reach. Probably a good thing. Another thing, another reason I might not have been here tonight, you know? But anyway, he got my wallet, and he got my briefcase and all this kind of stuff, and I was, you know, didn't like that either. Then I think the crux of it was one night, this guy got mad at his wife or girlfriend, whatever the situation was, and he hauled a TV out in the parking lot and dumped lighter fluid all over it and set it on fire. And I remember my sponsor telling me to try and know the difference between needs and wants, you know, because God will give you what you need. you know. But what you want ain't necessarily what you need, you know. I hit my knees that night, and at that time I was working for Haverty's. I got to back up a spec. I was working for Haverty's, and I was working in a clearance center, and we were sending a lot of furniture out, chipped and busted, to a place called Carp. Found out that I can't break her anonymity. Forget that. I didn't say that. Anyway, there was a guy there that had our vending machines, and he brought in cigarettes and candies and soft drinks and all this kind of stuff. And he made a deal with me to keep an eye on his machines for him while he wasn't there, to make sure they didn't try to steal them with a forklift or whatever, or empty them, turn them upside down, which they have done before, you know. And him and I had a little thing going with that, and every time he'd come over to fill the machines, we'd go outside and smoke a cigarette and, you know, and talk. And he was not in the program. One night, after the machine gun fire and all this stuff going off in the apartment, I hit my knees and I asked God for help. And I said, God, I don't know the difference between a want and a need, but I believe this is a need. I really need to get out of this apartment. You know, I fear for my life. That's not safe here. And I need to get out of this apartment. I have no money. I know you're not a bank, but I don't even have enough money to go and put a down payment for another apartment, much less, you know, anything else. And I went to work the next day, and this vendor was there, and we went out and smoked a cigarette. And he said, Ed, he says, you know anybody? I'm going to get crying on this one. He said, do you know anybody that needs a house? Yeah. He said, well, he says, I'm getting married. My wife's got this daggone condo. He says, I got a house on 4 acres. He says, I don't need this condo. He says, she's been paying on this condo and living there. He says, we just want to get rid of it, you know, and she wants to get her equity out of it. And I said, well, that stops me right there, you know. And he said, no. He says, I told her that we're spending more money on monthly payments for this thing than her equity in a short period of time, and we need to get rid of it, period. He said, are you interested in it? And I said, well, yeah. He said, well, I'll tell you what I'll do. He said, it's an assumable loan. He said, you can assume the loan. Cost you nothing. He said, and I'll pay next month's payment to give you a start. Well, I went over to the house, took a look at it, and make sure it's something I wanted. You know, I didn't want no just piece of junk house, you know. That'd be a nice house. And it was a nice house. It really was. I'll tell you what, compared to that big, beautiful home on the hill, with the swimming pool and the cars in the driveway and the kids in the home and the whole thing, it was 50 times better. Nobody outside this program can understand that. If you haven't been there, you don't know what I'm saying, you know? And it was wonderful. We did some fixing up on it, and oh, I got to tell you this. I went over to Clarkson. I didn't know what the hell. I went to work the next day. Went in the office. And I'm like, what am I supposed to do? And my sponsor always told me, take the next step. Take the next step. Do the next right thing. Da-da-da-da-da. You know, so that's what I was doing. I went to work the next day, and I called the mortgage company and asked them what they need. They said they need someone to handle the package, preferably a lawyer. I'm like, what package? She said, there's a package. If you talk to your lawyer, he'll know what it is. I never have found out what that package was. That's the truth. I have never found out what that package was. I mean, I got an idea, but I never have found out exactly what it was. I went to my office. I got on the telephone, and this is gospel truth. I got on the telephone, and I went down the yellow pages, and I started calling lawyers. And I started telling lawyers what I needed. And I started telling lawyers that I was an alcoholic. And I started telling lawyers that I needed help. One lawyer tells me, he said, look, he says, I got somebody that might help you. He said, give me your phone number and I'll have them call you. And I remember hanging the phone up thinking, hey, I'll never hear from them. It was short time after that. The phone rang, told me who he was. He's in the program. He charged me $125 to handle the package. And I paid it in payments. Now, who did that? Was it me? I don't think so. I went back to Clarkston, which was my home group at that time. I went back to Clarkston, and I announced that I needed help. Now, here's a guy that never asked for help in his life. And I went back and announced I needed some help. I said, I got to get out of my apartment. I got a new home, and I don't have any money for a moving van. I don't have any money for nothing, you know, much gas money. That's about it, you know. The next day, I had 7 pickup trucks at my apartment. The women were involved as well. They packed my dishes. They packed my silverware. They packed all of the stuff, you know, and put it into boxes, loaded it on these pickup trucks. These pickup trucks went over to my house. These guys helped me unpack my clothes and hang my clothes up while the women were in the kitchen putting away my dishes and my silverware and my pots and pans. It cost me a case of Coca-Cola and a bucket of chicken. They would not even take gas money from me. You know? Who did that? You know, from there, I went on to meet this girl. She was a little taller than I was, blonde hair. She wasn't Italian. But she's my sweetheart and my partner and my love today. She 13-stepped me. I had nothing to do with it. I found out that she worked out in a gym. So I asked her casually in a meeting one time, you know, hey, how would you like to go work out in the gym together one time? You know, we could do that. I work out all the time, you know. She said, I'll think about it. And I don't know, a couple of days later, she called me at work, and she says, I don't know if I guess I can say this. She said, were you full of crap? Okay, were you full of crap? Or were you serious? I said, I was serious. You know, she said, okay, meet me at the gym. She gave me directions and, you know, meet me there tonight after work. And I said, okay, so we met over there. And she gets on the crunch machine. She sits me on the crunch machine. And, you know, I'm a dead weight lifter, you know, at my young age. Not then, you know, I'm talking about when I was 17, 18, 19 years old. You know, martial arts was my hobby and weights I loved to do, you know. But I hadn't touched them in years and years and years and years, you know. I go in there and she introduces me to this crunch machine, you know. And I'm sitting there grabbing a hold of this bar and I said, how much weight should I put on here? And she says, I usually work out with 80 pounds. Just like, what? You know, she's been the boss ever since. She made me out to look like a fool in the weight room. I kid you not. But, you know, we have been 100% compatible. And we really do. Our heads think alike. We act alike. I don't know what all to tell you about the relationship that her and I have. I mean, we're completely open with each other. We don't lie to each other. We don't keep things from each other. We dearly love each other. When we decided to get married, I proposed to her in front of a group like this. I was sitting there. I was sitting there, and I had the ring in my pocket, and she was giving me my chip. And she looked over at me and she said, what the hell are you so nervous about? She said, you've gotten chips before. You know, why are you so excited? You know, she didn't have a clue that what was happening was going to happen, you know. And when she got up, when she handed me the chip, I handed her the diamond ring back and asked her to marry me. Needless to say, she said yes. Of course, the audience had something to do with it. They all shouted simultaneously, "Well, answer him!" We decided to get married, and I was trying to think of some way to get married. We wanted to get married something unusual, something different, because everything we do is unusual and different. Our shrubs are unusual and different. Everything is unusual and different. And we decided we wanted her place, her spiritual place was on top of Stone Mountain. My spiritual place was on top of Stone Mountain. Early on, that roommate that I told you about that we got along so good, he and I would walk up Stone Mountain in the dark and watch the sun come up in the mornings. And that was a spiritual thing for me. To watch its sun peek up over the trees from the top of Stone Mountain is incredible. It is absolutely incredible. We decided we wanted to get married at sunrise on top of Stone Mountain. I try and pull that off one time. You know, we had to find a preacher, number one, that was willing to walk up Stone Mountain. Because, see, whatever that thing's called, doesn't operate. Easter Sunday it does, but normally it doesn't operate until like 9 o'clock in the morning. Sunrise gone by then, you know. Well, we found a preacher through our group that was a woman minister and a triathlon. And she thought that was a great idea. And you know, when I got up there, one of my best friends took a picture of my feet. Now, you got to understand that she's a lot taller than I am, so I was standing on a rock, you know. So we were the same height, and my buddy took a picture of our feet so he could bug me about it for the rest of my life, you know. But I turned around and looked behind me, and there were 60 people that had walked up there in the dark to watch her and I get married, you know. Every one a drunk. Everyone just like me, you know. We decided we wanted to get rid of this little townhouse. Wasn't suitable anymore. And we bought a little 850 square foot, two half bedrooms, actually. There weren't no one whole bedroom in upper place. It was two half bedrooms and a little piece of a bathroom. And but it had a beautiful tree in the front yard, and it had a 100-year-old oak tree in the backyard, and both of us fell in love with this piece of crap, believe it or not. And we decided we were going to buy this place and do something with it. I am now a contractor, so board by board, nail by nail, whatever, this house now is 3,000 square feet. Has a 1,400 square foot, four level deck on the back of it with three fireplaces. Is that alcoholic or what? And we live there happily ever after with our dogs. And she's a dog person, I'm a dog person. And let me see, what did I forget? Oh, I did want to say when I first came in here, about this guy, I'm done. I want to tell you about a guy that fed me my first meal when I came in the program, because it, you know, I just think it's fitting. He was a guy that I would not sit next to on the bus, and I mean that's how scungy he was. He was a drunk just like me, you know. But he knew I didn't have any money and I was hungry, and he took me out to the Waffle House and treated me to dinner. You know, and I can recall sitting there looking at this guy across from me that had just bought me dinner and wondering where the hell he got the money to do that with and why he did that. What's he up to? You know, what does he want in return? And he told me, he said, next time somebody is hungry, feed them. That's what I want in return. You know? I want to thank you all for being here tonight. And they didn't all leave like you said they were. She said, don't be excited. You know, it's not personal if people get up and leave and people walk around and all this kind of stuff. I haven't seen very many people move. I thank you very much.
Okay, y'all. I'm so grateful for that story. And I know a little bit more than he was able to share tonight. I just have seen them. I've just heard the miracles that have occurred in his life, and they occur in mine too. And it's because I'm doing what I'm told. So I just want to encourage everyone today. I've asked a very special friend, Susan, to explain the chip system.
Thank you.